Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Identity politics have had a big ride in American political culture in recent years. Lots of talk about race and gender and sexual identity. In the wake of Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump, critics are saying identity liberalism is out of gas politically, that it needs to recede in favor of a broader political message. Maybe so, but now there's white identity politics stirring. This hour On Point, the future of identity politics. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you think that identity politics lost Hillary Clinton the election? Were talk of diversity and issues of difference too present or not? And what about identity politics on the right? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. There are plenty of voices out there who are on this theme now. Here's a former Democratic candidate for president, former U.S. Senator, Secretary of Navy under Ronald Reagan, Jim Webb, talking with Fox News last week about the way the Democratic Party, he said, has forgotten its working class, white working class base.
The base of the Democratic Party used to be working people, regardless of race, ethnic identity, or sexual orientation, et cetera. Yeah. That was the Roosevelt agenda.
Exactly.
That was the Truman agenda. And over time, and I think particularly over the last 8 years, the Democratic Party had moved into interest group politics, and in many cases, white working people have become the whipping posts, or were.
And here's Senator Bernie Sanders in Boston last Sunday.
It is not good enough for somebody to say, I'm a woman, vote for me. No, that's not good enough. What we need is a woman who has the guts to stand up to Wall Street, to the insurance companies, to the drug companies, to the fossil fuel industry.
My colleague Simone Rios from WBR bringing us that tape right there. Joining me first today from New York is Mark Lilla, professor of humanities at Columbia University, author of the book The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction. His piece in the New York Times last weekend was headlined The End of Identity Liberalism. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Lilla, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
You start this essay with kind of a beautiful paragraph. I'll read it if I may. It says, it's a truism that America has become a more diverse country. It's also a beautiful thing to watch. Visitors from other countries, particularly those having trouble incorporating different ethnic groups and faiths, are amazed that we managed to pull it off. Not perfectly, of course, but certainly better than any European or Asian nation today. It's an extraordinary success story. So you celebrate American diversity, and yet you say identity liberalism has run its course. Why?
Well, fundamentally, politics is about the acquisition of and the use of power. And democratic politics requires being able to win elections, quite simply, win elections, and to exercise power through the institutions we have. But in order to do that, you cannot simply do it by dictate or simply winning one election. You need to have the country with you. You know, Abraham Lincoln once said, I'm going to be paraphrasing, this is from the Lincoln-Douglas debates, that with public sentiment in a democracy, one can do everything. Without it, one can do nothing. And therefore, in order to win elections in the long term, you have to win the country. You need to give the country a narrative of what it is, where it's going, what its history has been, what its aspirations are, and you need that message to move enough people so that they see each other as involved in a common project, so that they will vote for you and you can defend the people that you need to defend. And what that means, particularly when it comes to our diversity, is that in order to help disadvantaged people who are minorities, you need to get the whole country along with you in order to vote you into power. Noble defeats do nothing to help those who are the most disadvantaged in this country. We must focus on winning elections again.
You don't think that's – I guess you're taking Hillary Clinton's defeat as evidence that her way won't work? There was a lot of talk in advance of the election. Of course, it turned out to be wrong in the Electoral College vote. But that demographics and more progressive social culture were all trending the Democrats' way.
No, but that's not what I mean. That's what I mean by public sentiment. I mean, just to say the obvious, she won the election in terms of the popular vote. But the fact is that the Democratic Party has been the losing party out in the country essentially since the election of Ronald Reagan, that the energy has been on the right. We have, I think, 31 or 32 governorships that are Republican. We have roughly the same number of state legislatures. At the county level, it gets even worse. And we have, I think it's 24 states where you have both a Republican governor and you have a Republican legislature. The national narrative has been captured by the kind of people who are on Fox News. They have an account of what the nation is, of what our economy should look like, what makes us Americans, and I reject almost entirely their view of what we are and what we should be. But they have an account. They have an account that people can subscribe to. On the Democratic side, we need an account that not only appeals to people that are in the traditional Democratic coalition, which is both groups that are worried about economic issues and groups that are worried about race and social protection and the rest, but it has to be an account that also grabs enough voters in the middle to see that they share something with us. And so we need a rhetoric of commonality. Now, commonality does not mean homogeneity. When I walk into the DMV, I'm there with a group of people who share one thing. We're standing in long lines and we need our license. Mm-hmm. We are drivers. That does not mean that we share an identity. We share a characteristic. And when it comes to voting and thinking about large national questions, what we share is our citizenship. And what we demand and have every right to demand is that as citizens, the laws be applied equally to all of us and that the government work for this, the general welfare of the population. And so all the questions, you know, I've gotten quite a response to my article, and many of them are based on a misconception of what I was saying. My point is not that we no longer have to defend black motorists who are being roughed up by police or gay and lesbian and transgender people that are beaten up on street corners or in dark alleys. We have to do that. But what we have to do is convince Middle America that this violation of people's rights as citizens is something they ought to care about, not because they have a metaphysics of identity and understand necessarily what it is to be inside your head if you're one of these groups, but simply because we are a nation of rights and equal protection. And by stressing what we share as citizens and our rights, we have something that can that's a tool to get people in the middle to agree with us.
You write that on the campaign trail, you say Hillary Clinton slipped into the rhetoric of diversity, calling out explicitly to African-American, Latino, LGBT, and women voters at every stop. You say this was a strategic mistake. If you're going to mention groups in America, you'd better mention all of them, you write. Of course, she didn't only talk about that. Was she really a captive of identity politics? Can you not mention those things? We've got a lot of history in this country that people may say needs to be addressed, even as you look at the big picture.
Oh, in terms of our general political discourse, of course. She's trying to win an election, and she is going up against the most dangerous man ever to run for national office. Now, I think the advice that she got was that what we need to do – basically, we're going to win – and what we need to do is boost turnout among the people who are normally with us. And I think that was part of the strategy. But when it comes to that sort of campaign rhetoric, one thing that liberals and progressives need to face up to is that everything they say is now being filtered through Fox News and conservative radio. It's if there's anything deplorable, it's that. In our politics right now. But it's a reality. And if you want to reach people, sort of break through that spam filter or truth filter that's surrounding people in the middle, you've got to tailor your message in a way that passes through it. It's just a fact. It's an awful fact, but it is a fact. That's why I'm so frustrated. The political capital was lost over the past couple years in debates over bathroom use at a time when the Democratic Party and liberals more generally face this enormous challenge. It's not that we don't have an issue there and we can deal with it. You do not emphasize that. That is simply because there frankly, it's a kind of adolescent response. You want recognition without paying attention to the consequences. We're in a minority in terms of our message right now. So face that and accept it and be strategic. That's what I'm saying.
In a word, do you feel an irony in you're saying identity liberalism is at an end, but identity politics may be growing on the right, the hard right?
Well, I think there's a connection. We can talk about that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about identity politics in this country now, sexual identity, gender, race. My guest, Mark Lilla, says those won't work for Democrats anymore. Some Republicans now climbing on hard with white identity, some picture out there. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is identity liberalism over? Did it cost Hillary Clinton the election? Should she have talked less about racial minorities and women and more about economics and take-home pay? Or is speaking to this country's diversity morally and maybe even somehow politically essential? What if it's morally essential but it doesn't win elections? Here's a little sound of Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. This was in April. She was talking to the National Action Network. It's a civil rights group. Here's saying how white Americans need to recognize their privilege, understand that black Americans have different experiences.
White Americans need to do a much better job of listening when African Americans talk about the seen and unseen barriers you face every day. We need to recognize our privilege and practice humility, rather than assume our experiences are everyone else's experiences.
Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. Since the election defeat, a different message in some quarters out there, Democratic country. Here's on CNN State of the Union on Sunday, Ohio Democratic Rep. Tim Ryan looking toward that Democratic leadership position. They're saying that the party needs to shift its messaging.
We need a brand as a party that says we are the party that are going to help working class people, white people, black people, brown people, gay people, straight people, improve opportunity for them to grow their wages, to have security, economic security. And we got off that message. And when we don't talk about economics, we lose elections.
Get off that message, says a Democrat who's pushing for an even bigger position there. But while that's going on, meanwhile, since the election, we had last weekend white nationalists at the Ronald Reagan Federal Building in Washington, not so far from the White House. Video released came out of their the head of the National Policy Institute there, celebrating essentially just white supremacy.
America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance, and it belongs to us.
And by us, he clearly meant white Americans right there. There even were Nazi salutes going up in that hall. Mark Lilla is with us, professor of humanities at Columbia University. Wrote an essay headlined The End of Identity Liberalism for the New York Times last weekend. Author of The Shipwrecked Mind joins us today from New York. Van Newkirk and Michelle Goldberg join us in just a moment. Mark Lilly, you were saying just before the break that there's a line from what we just heard there from this white nationalist figure to your argument that on identity politics. What is it?
Well, let me just say that my new book, The Shipwrecked Mind, the subtitle of it is On Political Reaction. And I've been interested in a very long time in understanding the reactionary mind. What is it that makes people, in a sense, crack and develop a historical narrative that presents the past in some idealized way, treats the present as unbearable, and teaches that either one needs to go exactly to what the past was or to destroy the present in order to jump into a future that will be inspired by the past. And this white nationalism fits exactly into the things that my book was talking about. I'd like to begin answering, though, by going back to Hillary Clinton's remark. What she said is beautiful. It's simply beautiful.
Be mindful of white privilege.
Well, no, with the latter part. I mean, the word privilege, that's not going to attract anybody. I mean, there she's asking for a conversion. Get down on your knees and confess your sins. And that's what we do in America. We all want to be preachers. But when she said, you've got to understand people different from yourself and what they're going through, that is an important moral principle. And that's the job of our educational system. It's the job of our churches to bring home this message to people. And once people are elected, it's their job, once they have office, to make that clear. But the way she put it, to my ears when I put myself in the reactionary mind, was aggressive and divisive because it was asking for a confession and a conversion. Now, the history of this alt-right, which I've also been studying for some time, is complicated. It's actually very tied to things that are going on in Europe. I think we have to remember that, you know, what we're seeing, these disturbing phenomena on that kind of right, those phenomena are apparent all over Europe right now, right? So it's not just an American problem. It has to do with the displacement of a certain class. It has to do with, I think, real changes in society, but also changes in the way society is presented by the media. For example, Hollywood does not present us a picture of America as it is. It presents us an idealized picture in which all the space captains are women and all the science officers are black and all the rest.
It's but of course for a long, long time it did not do that.
That's right. So we provided one false picture of America and we've replace it with another false, but an idealized and morally improved one, but it's not a picture of America.
Well, are you suggesting people that liberals have provoked white nationalism?
No. What they have done is they've given opportunities for the whole right-wing machine that's being run out of Fox News and those conservative radio hosts who are holding their listeners hostage and protecting them and cherry-picking things in such a way that they're able to provide a distorted picture of what people are saying and what they're about. And we must be mindful of that. Now, none of this is to excuse anything on the alt-right. And in fact, the alt-right is not going to appeal to much of anyone. I mean, it's a fringe element. And though there has been a kind of softening on the conservative side, so-called conservative side, that is worrisome. And this absolutely has to be combated. And Donald Trump needs to come out very clearly and combat this. So it's not the alt-right. We don't need to look at that. We have to look at a kind of frustration. Michelle Goldberg, who I assume
she'll
is
join
coming
us in a moment.
Yeah, she wrote a wonderful piece in Slate, kind of agreeing with some of my points, disagreeing with the larger message, and it was excellent. And at a certain point, she said that how often she heard from people out in the campaign trail, "I'm sick of this political correctness."
Unpacking that is
a very difficult thing. But we need to do that, and we need to try to own up to not putting ourselves in a position to be characterized like that.
I want to get Michelle in with us and Van Newkirk as well in just a moment. We've got callers waiting. But I want to just get out here. You say that Democrats need a post-identity liberalism. What does that mean?
It means an identity. It means a liberalism that once again talks to citizens as citizens, whatever their backgrounds or identities are, that focuses on principles and defending them for everyone without needing a metaphysics of identity, and that focuses on very basic things like Roosevelt's Four Freedoms, which is what I end with.
A couple of listeners, and I'll go to Michelle and Van. Helen in Suwannee, Tennessee. Helen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. My comment is I do kind of agree with the speaker. I was very fortunate to be a delegate to the DNC in 2012, and maybe they've changed the composition of their panels since then, but at that time, all the little breakout panels that they had during the day were, you know, based on identity. There was, you know, the Women's Caucus, a Latino one, LGBT one, African-American, small business owners. I don't fit any of those categories. And I wondered, why didn't they have them according to your interests, like, say, an education one, an environmental one, an economic justice one, or a healthcare one, and that people would go to, whether they were Black or Latino or gay or anything, if you care about economic justice, go to that. You know,
Helen, what would you say to an African-American, let's say, or someone else who said, well, okay, but there's so much history here, we need to address it. We need to focus on these categories because they've been historically and categorically disempowered.
Yeah, I totally support that, and I think that you could also have an African American panel too, but maybe do it more according to what your interests are, because I think there's a lot of African Americans who care about economic justice, and just like white people do too, and it also really disturbs me that you know, the problem of offshoring has become a white nationalist issue, because I am definitely not a white nationalist, but that's something I care very greatly about.
And let me call it right there, if I may, and I really appreciate your call. But we have so many callers and guests lined up here. One more, Carol in Providence, Rhode Island. Carol, you're on the air. Thank you.
Hi, Tom and Professor Lula. Barnard 85 here. Listen, I just want to call this entire argument into question, and what I'd like to say is that, you know, we know that, as Professor Lula said, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, done, okay? We know that the reason Donald Trump will be able to appoint a Supreme Court justice is because the Republicans refused to appoint President Obama's justice or even consider that justice. We know that the Republicans gerrymandered the House. This has been well documented. So you can say, well, you need to win elections. But you can also say, and I think I've heard this before, that the system is rigged. There are real questions about what the usefulness of an electoral college is if they're not going to question the appropriateness of a president-elect like Donald Trump.
And Carol, I take your point. I take it fully. But in our system, the obvious way to turn that around is to overwhelm it electorally, right?
I mean, that is right. I mean, but the problem is that I don't know that we've ever in history had a candidate like Hillary Clinton lose the Electoral College yet win by 1.7 million votes.
Yeah.
And this is the second time in the space of 20 years that it's happened because, we know this happened with Bush v. Gore. And so clearly what you're seeing, and you can talk about identity politics, but I think the more interesting conversation has to do with urban versus rural. And it's the same thing that you saw with Brexit, that people thought they knew the outcome so they didn't turn out. And I think the more interesting dialogue to be had in this country is, okay, if we really want socialism, then we don't have to worry about what happens to people when their jobs go away. We can take care of them. But if we say we believe in capitalism, then we have to recognize that those people are going to get ground under the wheel. So we need a little more clear understanding of how our democratic processes are working.
Carol, I appreciate your call. I'm going to take it right there, if I may. I think we got it in the main, and we've got so many waiting here. Mark Lilly, with permission, I want to just note there, Carol says it's not identity politics, or it's a rigged system. We've heard that. Let me get Van Newkirk and Michelle Goldberg in here. Van Newkirk is a staff writer at The Atlantic, covers politics and policy. He's been writing on this front. Most recent piece, This Is Who We Are. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Van Newkirk from Atlanta, Georgia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Michelle Goldberg, columnist for Slate Magazine. Great essay from her as well. You'll find it at our website. Democratic politics have to be identity politics. Michelle, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Van, first to you. What do you make of the argument that identity liberalism is more or less dead, Mark Lilly is saying?
Well, I would actually question the idea that it's sort of undergirded the party at all in a significant way. I think Mark ends the essay in what is a powerful sort of recollection of Roosevelt's Four Freedoms. And what I would point out is that Roosevelt's policy specifically carved out people of color from the New Deal. And I think we look at sort of all these impulses among Democrats, liberals in general, to move away from identity that have happened cyclically in American history. Mm-hmm. You look at Bill Clinton's triangulation. I think the piece also mentions Reagan's sort of appeal to all common Americans. What those two presidents have in common is their policies were disastrous, and especially in criminal justice reform, for especially African Americans. And I think that we've sort of overstated the role of identity politics in this election, especially when it comes on the heels of what I believe was undeniably two successful elections of identity.
Are you saying you wish there were more identity politics in the Democratic Party push, Van?
I believe, I think Obama showed us that you can win embracing identity. And I would actually say you might need more, yes.
I mean, certainly his identity was important to his victory, but it often seemed to me that in office he kind of soft-pedaled that, personal impression anyway. Michelle Goldberg, your reaction to Mark's overall assertion, end of the road for identity liberalism.
I think that as I said in my piece, there's certainly certain parts of it that I agree with. I'm kind of no fan of the bullying, hectoring tone that is, kind of dominant universities and that has spread a little bit outside of the universities, and that at least some of the people that I spoke to at Trump rallies were responding to. They felt like they were being, shamed for violating a set of speech codes that they didn't really understand and had never agreed to. And part of this is a problem of social media and the way it collapses different social contexts, so that, somebody in Iowa is suddenly being judged according to standards of the Upper West Side. But I also talked to a lot of people who, when they said they were sick of political correctness and sick of identity politics, they kind of meant that they were sick of not being able to blame the budget deficit on, lazy African Americans. They were sick of not being able to say that they weren't sure that a woman could be president. And so I think it's a mistake not to understand that at least some of this is an irreducible clash of values. And it would be, I think, both a moral and strategic mistake for the Democratic Party to, Mark said, pitch itself to the voter whose entire worldview is being shaped by Fox News, as opposed to the majority of people that did, in fact, vote for Hillary Clinton. And I understand that you have to go into an election with the system that you have. And we are in a system that disproportionately favors white rural voters and really disadvantages and disenfranchises people in the city in a way that I think is ultimately democratically unsustainable if we want to call ourselves a democracy. But I think we have to understand that right now the most urgent imperative for the Democratic Party and for progressives is to protect the people who are under attack precisely because of their identity, right? This is an administration that has promised an unprecedented assault on the civil rights of Muslims.
How do you protect those people when you don't have the Congress or the White House or soon the Supreme Court?
Well, in the short term, I think that, you know, we've seen, I think we can take a page from Mitch McConnell in the short term, who didn't respond to the Republican Party's loss in 2008 and 2012 with a lot of soul searching and attempts to reach across the aisle, but instead basically hunkered down and said no to everything that Obama wanted to do.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about identity politics and this country now, sexual identity, gender, race. My guest Mark Lilla says those won't work for Democrats anymore, strategically. He's from Columbia University. His new book is The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction. Also with us, Van Newkirk, staff writer at The Atlantic, who's been writing on this front, and Michelle Goldberg from Slate Magazine. She's in New York. Van's in Atlanta, Georgia. You can join us as well. Do you buy the premise that identity liberalism cost Hillary Clinton the election? And are we saying no to identity liberalism and hello to white nationalism? It's on a lot of people's minds. Last Sunday in Boston, Senator Bernie Sanders said that the Democratic Party needs to move away from identity politics.
One of the struggles that you're going to be seeing in the Democratic Party is whether we go beyond identity politics. I think it's a step forward in America if you have an African-American head of CEO of some major corporation. But you know what? If that guy is going to be shipping jobs out of this country and exploiting his workers, doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot whether he's black or white or Latino. All right? And I know, you know, some people may not agree with me, but that is the fight that we're going to have right now within the Democratic Party.
Bernie Sanders saying get beyond color and more. Bill Maher kind of weighing in here right after the election, season finale of his HBO program, sharing his takeaway from the 2016 election. A little advice for the Democratic Party from Bill Maher.
You're outrageous with your political correct, and it does drive people away.
Okay, simple as that from Bill Maher. But then, Michelle, Van, Mark, we saw on Friday this appeal from the stage in New York of the musical Hamilton, actor Brandon Dixon giving an impassioned curtain call speech addressed to the vice president-elect Mike Pence, who had attended that evening.
We are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us. All of us.
We, the diverse America. And then, of course, we got into Donald Trump bitterly complaining about that and all the rest. But there was the appeal from the stage. Van Newkirk in Atlanta, Georgia, what about the notion that it needs to be an appeal to common interests here rather than identity interests?
Well, I think the appeal to identity interests, and I'll start with an example. I think Martin Luther King Jr. was perhaps both our leading expert, our template for appealing to universal humanitarian and issues in humanity, and also our best template for identity issues. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I think you can appeal to a common thread of humanity and a common Americanness while also making sure that you appeal to what's good for black people, what's good for poor folks. I don't buy the idea that the opposite of identity politics is class politics. I think we've sort of sold ourselves on this notion, and I think Senator Sanders does almost sort of the same thing where we say class supersedes race, sex, gender, all these different issues.
What's wrong with that approach, Van?
Well, for one, I think we do a lot of this with women's issues, and women are more than half the country. That seems to me to be sort of backwards. You know, if we looked at a common thread mathematically, just appealing to women's issues, period, should be a common thread issue. But I think what's wrong with that sort of false binary is the fact that I believe that you can say sort of what Hillary Clinton said on the trail, which is you should listen to people of color. You should listen to Latino immigrants and think about your privilege as a white American for whom politics has always been identity politics. And we can have that conversation without eroding our identities as people. And I just don't know if logically it connects that identity politics is sort of the opposite of solidarity.
Michelle Goldberg, Mark's argument, and he'll make it himself again in a moment here, but is that you can't entirely maybe have it both ways at the moment. If you want to win and you want to have the power to act on a set of ideas about the country, you've got to get in there. I mean, you acknowledge some elements of what he's saying, but you're pretty tough as well. You talk about the critics of identity politics, and you say they're objecting not to the absurd excesses of political correctness, but to race and gender politics themselves.
I think that is an accurate description, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders, and I have a lot of admiration for Bernie Sanders in a lot of ways, but what he's basically saying is that, you know, we should not be emphasizing things like having more women in leadership. We should not be emphasizing things like having more people of color in leadership, that the only thing, or at least the kind of guiding paradigm of progressive politics, can only be about class. And without, I think, a proper realization of the degree to which the working class is mostly women and people of color who are discriminated against and find themselves oppressed not just because of their class status, but for all kinds of other reasons. I mean, you know, most obviously in the case of women, in case of working class women, not making as much as their male peers. And so to me, the problem is that I think that what we're going to see right now, and we've seen this in the wake of other Democratic defeats, is there's going to be this kind of backlash of, you know, women and people of color, okay, we've tried this, it didn't work, now let's get back to the quote-unquote real people, the heartland. When, in fact, the American majority are the people who are being, whose material interests, whose safety is going to be substantially threatened by the minority that is going to rule us. And I think that you can, if you go too far towards trying to appeal to, you know, people who filter the world through Fox News, people who resent the changing demographics of the United States, people who resent the kind of collapse or erosion of the sexual hierarchy in the United States, you are going to sell out and demoralize the other people that you need to win, right? Because there was a big problem in the Hillary Clinton campaign with enthusiasm among young people, enthusiasm among African Americans, and a substantial part of that was the fallout from exactly the sort of moves that Bill Clinton made to appeal to the white working class, right? So it's a very delicate balance, and I think that right now the Democratic Party needs to take care of the Democratic base precisely because even though they are the majority, they have no representation in the federal government.
Mark Little, I'm going to ask you to respond to that nuance in just a second, but a couple of calls here. Stina in Michigan, Waterford, Michigan. Stina, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My point may already have been made, but I think it's important to repeat it. And that is that the Democratic Party has historically stood for the rights of and protections of minorities. I think we lose that battle, we lose that dialogue to our peril and to our nation's peril. I don't think it's a dichotomy. I don't think it's either or. I think we have to do both.
Why did Hillary lose, Stina?
Well, I think the mistake that Hillary Clinton made was not passionately going after the economic structure that has damaged so many of us, whether we're white, and I'm Latino Swedish, so there you are.
Okay.
But whether we're white or black or brown, whether we're gay or straight, the structure of the economy as it stands hurts us. And that's what Bernie did. what you had was two Democrats addressing two constituencies. What you've got to do is passionately merge that message.
Bernie's saying get off identity politics now. We just heard him, right?
Pardon me?
Bernie's now saying get off of identity politics.
I love Bernie. I voted for him in the Michigan primary, and he won in Michigan and Wisconsin. But the fact of the matter remains is it's not that simple. To focus solely on the economics is to ignore the disbalance and the danger that minorities have historically found themselves in.
The nature of
a democracy is to not permit the tyranny of the majority.
We've got it, and you're very clear and good on it, but more of a common economic narrative from Hillary Clinton would have helped you say. One more right here, and I'll come to you, Mark. Auburn, Alabama, Scott is calling. Scott, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I want to present the other side a little bit. With all due respect to your speakers, when they talk about Middle America, they remind me of Belgians talking about the Congo in 1910. They utterly drip with condescension. They don't realize they do because everybody in their world talks the way they do. So today we've heard the phrase reactionary minds by your first speaker.
Okay.
The lady from Salon says their entire world is being shaped by Fox News, which
Slate.
I find laughable because Salon may be as
Slate.
Wacky
Slate.
Out there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Salon, you have HuffPost, you have Mother. All of those produce a condescension and, frankly, a hate that they just simply don't recognize. And so we have this disproportionate idea that 200 idiots in a convention, which I absolutely call idiots, somehow equals the condescension at Harvard and Yale and MIT and all of the entire media establishment. You know, to hear Van Newkirk, whose father is a PhD, my father didn't go to college, talk about white privilege, gets old to these folks. And you guys have truthfully no, and I mean that very sincerely, no understanding of the people you talk about. You talk about them like experiment subjects. There may be some psychology.
You know, Scott, I hear the theme. You put it out there, but yet these are also your fellow Americans. They're also living lives every day in this country, maybe in a different circumstance, maybe from a different perspective, but they are not from Belgium. So just to note that. But what do you see as a reality then, Scott?
Here's what wins. What wins is our commonality as Americans. What wins is content of their character. What wins is melting pot. What wins is we are all Americans, not the balkanization of America, which is what two out of three of your speakers want to do. They want to divide us into little bitty groups. And most of us, they think because they interviewed three people or 30 people, I don't care, at a Trump rally, that somehow represents the people that voted for him. I didn't vote for him because I think he's an idiot. But yesterday I talked to an elderly judge in Alabama, a fine and decent man who's given most of his life to things that are for poor people, black people, et cetera, et cetera. But he voted for Trump. I asked him why. He said, I know what judges that Hillary would have put down. You guys act as if the reason Hillary didn't get elected has nothing to do with their corruption, with years and years and years and years and years that we've all put up with. It just gets old to those of us who watch you guys talk about Middle America as if you know something about it.
Scott, I mean, you should read Van Newkirk's piece. Link to it at our website. There's a lot of American experience right in it, and it's right in your backyard, including with his father, who loved driving through the South with his son, and recounting a moment when they had a pretty rough encounter just filling up with gas. I mean, these are realities too. But, Scott, I take your point, and I'm glad for your call. Mark Lilla, are the Democrats going to win Scott over?
Well, there's no reason why they should have lost him in the first place. And I am so pleased that Scott called in because it should be a wake-up call for a lot of people. I just want to put forward my own, just to relax him a little bit, my own background. I, too, was the first person in my family to go to college. I grew up in a working-class area of Detroit. I was an evangelical when I was young. I have Trump voters in my family. I come from a county called Macomb County, which is famous because it's kind of a bellwether county.
Went for Trump.
It went for Trump this time. In 1964, it went overwhelmingly for Johnson. and in 1972 gave the it had the highest percentage of the vote for George Wallace north of the Mason-Dixon line. So I have seen in my life people who should be part of the Democratic coalition get peeled away. And they get peeled away by cultural condescension. He's entirely correct. I would invite not only the other people on the panel, and maybe they have, but certainly listeners up in Boston, go to a megachurch. Just walk into any one that's not in an entirely segregated area. You're going to see black, white, Latina, Latino, and Asian worshipers with their Scofield reference Bibles open, their hands raised, singing, praising God, and speaking in tongues.
I got plenty of family who go right there, and I go with them. I know exactly what you're talking about. Let me put it to Michelle and Van. Van, the assertion that it's cultural condescension to stick with identity politics here.
Well, I'm from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. I grew up snapping chickens' necks on a farm, and so I don't quite get the sort of idea that all of us are condescending towards Middle America, and I also don't know if I buy the idea that Middle America is this one piece of a picture that we like to paint it as. For me, Middle America is lots of people who also look like me, who come from where I came from, who still are back home farming or driving trucks or working at gas stations, and I think they've much more than people who work in the Rust Belt or people who work in coal mines, what have you, they've been carved out of our political process much more.
Michelle, we're not going to get all the way around this today, but would you drop some of the identity politics to bring in some of the voters who might have made strategically the margin of victory in this race?
Well, I guess it depends on what kind of identity politics you're talking about. I mean, I think that, you know, Mark Lilla's piece talked about handling matters of sexuality and religion quietly in the proper sense and with the proper sense of scale. We are very likely going to lose the right to abortion in the next 4 years. To me, there is no proper sense of scale in responding to that. It requires, you know, it requires us to be as loud and as mobilized as possible. I don't know what the proper sense of scale is in responding to the registration and possible roundup of American Muslims. And I also, to be honest, I mean, listening to that caller from Alabama, you know, he speaks with as much contempt towards my culture as I've ever shown towards the Middle American heartland. I despise this idea that there's something more virtuous about these insular rural white parts of America than there are about our cities.
Michelle, this is all we have time for today. We're going to come back to this. I'd like to do it with the three of you, and before long, Michelle Goldberg at Slate, Van Newkirk at The Atlantic, Mark Lilla at Columbia University. Our great thanks to all of you today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.